together this afternoon in your word. We bless you and thank you. Amen. Very good. This portion, Vayigash, and he approached, this essay is titled Homestead and Holding Pen, and it's a passage from Genesis 47. Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they took hold of it, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. So with these words, the Torah describes the beginnings of the first galut. Galut is the Hebrew word for exile of the Jewish people, as Jacob and his 70 children and grandchildren relocated from the Holy Land and settled in the land of Egypt. On the face of it, it was quite an agreeable beginning. One of their own, Joseph, was the de facto ruler of Egypt. Goshen, the choicest bit of Egyptian real estate, was theirs to settle. And settle it they did, finding it fertile soil for their individual and communal growth in both the material and the spiritual sense. But the Hebrew word Vayachazu in the above quoted verse, which they have translated, they took hold of it, also translates, they were held by it. Both interpretations are cited by our sages. Rashi translates Vayachazu as related to the word Achuzah, landholding, and homestead. The Midrash interprets it to imply that the land held them and grasp them, like a man who is forcefully held. A similar paradox describes Jacob's feelings towards his new home. On the one hand, Jacob's 17 years in Egypt are considered to have been the best years of his life. On the other hand, the Haggadah states that Jacob descended to Egypt forced by the divine command. The Haggadah statement seems inconsistent with our sage's depiction of Jacob as a Merkava, the Hebrew word for chariot or vehicle, of the divine will, whose every limb was totally removed from physical concerns and served only as a vehicle to carry out God's will every moment of his life. Would a Merkava feel forced to fulfill a divine command? In truth, however, it was because Jacob was so absolutely attuned to the divine will that he felt forced into his exile in Egypt. For this is what God wants of us, that we should be fully invested in the endeavor to develop our galut, our exile experience or environment, and at the same time experience a perpetual desire to escape it. This quality defines our attitude toward galut. On the one hand, we know that no matter how hospitable our host country may be, and no matter how we may flourish, materially and spiritually, on foreign soil, galut is a prison. We know that galut dims our spiritual vision, hinders our national mission, and compromises our connection with God. For only as a nation dwelling on our land with the Holy Temple as the divine abode in our midst can we perceive the divine presence in the world, fully realize our role as a light to the nations, and fully implement all the mitzvot of the Torah, the lifeblood of our relationship with God. But we also know that we are in galut for a purpose. We know that we have been dispersed throughout the world, in order to reach and influence the whole of humanity. We know that it is only through our wanderings and tribulations of galut that we access and redeem the sparks of holiness, those pinpoints of divine potential which lie scattered in the most forsaken corners of the globe. So galut is an achuza in both senses of the word, a homestead to develop and a prison we much perpetually seek to escape. Indeed, it can only be the one if it is also the other. If we relate to galut solely as a prison, we will fail to properly utilize the tremendous opportunities it holds. But if we grow comfortable in this alien environment, we risk becoming a part of it. And if we become a part of the galut reality, God forbid, we could no more succeed in our efforts to develop and elevate it than the person who tries to lift himself up by pulling upward on the top of his own head. So when Jacob led the 70 members of his household, the 70 seedlings from which the Jewish nation was to grow, Israel's first exile, he did so as one forced by the divine command. As a divine chariot, Jacob had no will, desire, or striving, save the will of God. But Jacob knew that for him to want to go to Egypt would undermine the very purpose of his mission there. Jacob knew that the secret of Israel's survival in exile is the refusal to become reconciled with it, the refusal to accept it as a state that is normal or acceptable, much less desirable to us. He knew that only those who remain unwilling strangers to galut will succeed at mastering it as their homestead and exacting from it a bountiful spiritual harvest. Therein lies the deeper significance of Rashi's commentary on Genesis 46, where the Torah recounts God's words to Jacob as Jacob prepares to journey to Egypt. The Torah describes how after Jacob stops at Beersheba to bring offerings to God, God said to Israel in visions of the night, "Do not be afraid of going down into Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I myself will bring you up again." Citing the words, "Do not be afraid of going down into Egypt," Rashi adds, because he was pained over the necessity to leave the Holy Land. The simple meaning of Rashi's words is that they come to explain the cause of Jacob's fears and his need for divine assurance. On a deeper level, Rashi is telling us why Jacob need not fear his descent to Egypt, because he was pained over the necessity to leave the land. Because Jacob experienced pain over the need to leave the holy environment of the land of Israel, because he would never feel at home on ancient soil, this itself was the ultimate guarantee that Jacob and his descendants would survive the Egyptian exile and emerge triumphant from the challenges of galut. So, there are several things to discuss on the basis of this essay. There are a couple of interesting passages back-to-back that we'll talk about briefly under item one. For this is what God wants of us, that we should be fully invested in the endeavor to develop our galut environment and at the same time experience a perpetual desire to escape it. So the first passage is from Jeremiah chapter 29. And these words of Jeremiah to the people of Israel are very interesting, because Jeremiah, of course, prophesied to the people of Israel and spoke to them about the impending captivity because of their sin. But Jeremiah also said that they would return to the land after 70 years. But in this passage from Jeremiah 29, this is the text of the letter that the prophet Jeremiah sent from Jerusalem to the surviving elders among the exiles and to the priests, the prophets and all the other people Nebuchadnezzar had carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. In verse 4, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. And notice what it says here. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. Also seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. So this is similar to what the Rebbe talks about regarding the kind of juxtaposition of competing interests, right? The idea that we should make peace with the exile and do our best to prosper in the exile, but to be careful not to adapt too completely to the exile, right? Because it, after all, is not really our home. And we ultimately, you know, want to be connected or bound together with the Lord, either in the land of Israel or in the Olam Haba, right? So there is this sense that we live in a place where there are always these competing values at work in our lives. This is something that Paul talks about in his letter to the Philippians. We've read this before, so I'm sure you're familiar with it. In the middle of this section, he talks about in verse 21 that for me to live is Messiah and to die is gain. If I am to go on living in the body, this will mean fruitful labor for me. Yet what shall I choose? I do not know. I am torn between the two. I desire to depart and be with Messiah, which is better by far, but it is more necessary for you that I remain in the body. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain, and I will continue with all of you for your progress and joy in the faith, right? So this is a kind of a real challenge that each of us faces, or at the very least should face, the challenge between the desire to be absent from the body and to be at one with the Lord, and then the competing desire to be in the body in a place where we can impact the lives of others, right? I mean, going to be with the Lord would obviously be a lot simpler, right? We could go to be with the Lord, and whatever issues or trauma that we are forced to deal with here on a regular basis, all of those things would evaporate in God's presence, right? But it's important for us to be here and do whatever it is that the Lord has called us to until our mission, our obligation is complete, until we've done whatever it is that we've been called to do, or as much of it as we can, and the Lord calls us home, right? So that's kind of a tension that exists between the instruction in the book of Jeremiah to make the best of the exile and to do what it is possible to do, to live life as normally as we can, and the desire to leave and to return to the land. And number two, we also know that we are in Galut for a purpose. We know that we have been dispersed throughout the world in order to reach and influence the whole community. We know that it is only through the wanderings and tribulations of Galut that we access and redeem the sparks of holiness, those pinpoints of divine potential which lie scattered in the most forsaken corners of the globe. Of course, this can't help but remind us of this passage in Exodus 19, where the Lord, just before he gives his people the Torah, speaks to them and says to them that they will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Right? These are the words that Moses is instructed to speak to the people of Israel. Right? Even though the priests are descended from Aaron, the whole nation was to be thought of as a nation of priests in the context of their relationship with the other nations of the world. In other words, the people of Israel were to be equipped with the Torah in such a way that it made reaching out to the nations not only possible but fruitful, right? The nations would be impacted by the character of a people that had drawn so close to God that they walked in his ways and lived out God's instructions. And people would see the benefit that those instructions bring people, right? And they would develop a heart for the things of God as well. One of the interesting comments from the book Every Man's Talmud, which is an anthology of the teaching of the Talmud. It's a great work if you have an interest in the Talmud and what it teaches. The ideal of the religion of the rabbis was the extension of God's kingship over all the peoples of the world. And the Jews had a constant reminder of it in the regulation. A benediction which contains no reference to the divine kingship is no benediction. That means that the benediction had to be introduced by the formula, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe." It followed from this that the doors could not be bolted against any Gentile who desired admittance from pure motives. On the verse and the souls that they had gotten, the Hebrew is literally made in Haran, a quote from Genesis 12. We are told Abraham made proselytes among the men and Sarah among the women. Whoever brings a heathen near to God and converts him is as though he had created him. And this final comment in bolded red letters is very telling. One rabbi even declared, "The Holy One, blessed be he, did not exile among the nations for any other reason than that proselyte should be added to them." Right? Now, what's interesting about that is that we see that happening, particularly in this passage in Acts chapter 8, where it talks about Saul approving the killing of Stephen. Right? He's brought before the court. He's accused and convicted of a capital crime, and he is stoned to death. On that day, a great persecution broke out against the Kehillah in Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. Godly men buried Stephen and mourned deeply for him, but Saul began to destroy the Kehillah. Going from house to house, he dragged off both men and women and put them in prison. But notice in verse 4 what happens to those who are scattered, right? They are scattered from Jerusalem throughout Judea and Samaria. Those who had been scattered preached the word wherever they went. So you could say that the words of the rabbi in this passage from the Talmud truly does express some of God's objective in scattering people to wherever it is that they're scattered to, right? Those who are scattered are intended to be a testimony of the good things of God. So, that's an aspect of the galut that we should continually keep in mind, that we are in the galut. We are living outside the land of Israel for a reason, right? And it's important for us to appreciate what that reason is, to appreciate it, to understand it, and to do our best to see that God's objective in our living, wherever it is that we happen to live, is facilitated, right? Number three, if we relate to Galut solely as a prison, we will fail to properly utilize the tremendous opportunities it holds. But if we grow comfortable in this alien environment, we risk becoming a part of it. And if we become a part of the Galut reality, God forbid, we could no more succeed in our efforts to develop and elevate it than the person who tries to lift himself up by pulling upward on the top of his own head. So, we're going to read a passage from this section of the Gospel of Luke and talk about the parable that is mentioned in this passage. This parable, according to Brad Young in his work on the parables, is regarded as one of the most, if not the most, perplexing of the parables of Yeshua, but it addresses some of the issues that we are discussing. So we're going to take the rest of the time and talk about this particular parable. Yeshua told his disciples there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer." The manager said to himself, "What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." So he called in each one of the master's debtors. He asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 900 gallons of olive oil," he replied. The manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. Then he asked the second, "And how much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat," he replied. He told him, "Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings." And then in verse 10, "Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So, if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." The irony with regard to this statement, "you cannot serve both God and money," if you think about it, is in many ways what this dishonest manager did, right? In other words, the statement is less about serving money without any appreciation for the things of God, or serving God without any appreciation for the things that money can provide, right? In other words, the statement here makes it sound as if you can only serve one at the exclusion of the other, right? And if you try to serve them both in the same way, then you will be like a person who is riding a fence with one foot in one yard and one foot in the other, right? So you straddle the fence. You're never completely at home in the one yard, and you're never completely at home in the other. But what did this dishonest manager do? And why is he commended for acting in the way he does? Which is why, as we discuss it, we'll come to see why this parable is regarded as one of the most, if not the most, perplexing of the parables of Yeshua. It is one that shocks the listener by glorifying the actions of a shady business character at the expense of his master's trust, money, and time. The steward watches out for himself. Does Yeshua promote dishonesty by telling a parable with such a rogue as its hero? Why would Yeshua praise the steward for his unethical wheeling and dealing, which costs the master dearly? Like all parables, the story was designed to excite the imagination with the irony of the master's response. A first reading of the text shows that a very rich man, probably the master of a large estate, discovers that a trusted steward is squandering his wealth in verse 1. Although described as wasteful, the student has a more grievous shortcoming. He is not just inefficient, he can't be trusted. It is for this reason that the rich man tells the estate manager to turn in his records, and he dismisses him. The brief period between his fateful meeting with the master and his final departure creates an opportunity for the crafty steward to implement his plan for self-preservation. He quickly calls in his master's debtors and ingratiates himself to them by reducing their debt. By giving them a generous discount, the unjust steward helps someone other than himself. To be sure, his actions were motivated by self-interest, but by reducing the debt, he was helping others. The main focus of the parable is money and stewardship. In the pursuit of God's kingdom, people must come before money. The proper stewardship of resources brings help to others. When God is one's master, money becomes a tool for assisting those in need. The steward was accumulating wealth exclusively for himself and not sharing it with others. The people of this world, literally, the sons or children of this age, in verse 8, are the more faithful stewards because of their commercial and social interaction with one another. And then item C is important. The application not only reveals a negative parody against the communal wealth of the Essenes, they kept their money in their own bank and harbored a sectarian hatred for outsiders and their unrighteous mammon. If you look at the footnote, the Essenes were a Jewish sect active in Israel from the 2nd century before the Common Era to the 1st century of the Common Era. They formed small monastic communities whose members strictly observed the laws of Moses and the Sabbath and held their property in common, right? What's interesting, of course, has to do with the fact that this is the only example in Jewish history of a monastic community. Judaism doesn't really support the idea of monasteries, the idea of communities withdrawing by themselves to a remote place where their only interaction is with the members of the community. That is something which is characteristic of Christianity and has been for 2,000 years, right? But it is not something which is characteristic of Judaism, and this is the only example of it in Jewish history. They withdrew from society, avoiding temple worship in Jerusalem, and supporting themselves by manual labor. They usually excluded women. It is likely that the Dead Sea Scrolls were composed, copied, or collected by the Essenes, right? But we're going to talk a little bit about them as we discuss this parable. Faithful stewardship of financial resources can take place only with and among people. Active involvement with the needs of others is essential. Financial resources should be put to work for social reform that benefits all. So this colorful story, this parable, which is difficult to understand apart from its original context, reveals rich Semitic imagery. The characters of a wealthy, magnanimous landowner and the rascal who plays the leading role of the drama are quite typical of gospel and rabbinic parables. Country living and the economics of farm management were well known to the common people. It is probable that the steward reduced the debt of tenant farmers who were required to pay a portion of their harvest in exchange for the use of good farming land. The steward supervised the deals involving land leasing, collective produce, keeping records, receiving income, and paying out disbursements as an agent of a wealthy landowner. The steward received both a salary and a commission, as well as kickbacks from grateful renters who recognized his authority and appreciated his favors. Although the steward is portrayed as wasting his master's possessions, his final action may actually have been legitimate in the eyes of the debtors, even if it was unethical and unjust. He may have been canceling his own sizable commission, which had been calculated into the amounts owed to his master. When called to account for his management in verse 2, the steward is silent. The audience would anticipate a loud and vocal defense, an attempt to save his job. The steward's silence is supremely significant in the Oriental context. The man is indirectly affirming by his silence at least the following. Number one, I am guilty. Number two, the master knows the truth. He knows I'm guilty. Number three, the master expects obedience. Disobedience brings judgment. And four, I can't get my job back by offering a series of excuses. The prospect of disgrace is also overwhelming in Oriental culture. Shame must be avoided, no matter what the cost. The words, I am not strong enough to dig, must have been very humorous for those listening, as they imagined a well-to-do, white-collar financial manager making a meager living harvesting crops in some sun-scorched field. But even if the steward was canceling his own sizable commission, the whole procedure of discounting the debts would not be considered ethical. In the shame and honor culture of the East, the story makes perfect sense. The master and his steward both wanted to avoid shame. Such unprecedented generosity on behalf of the rich man would be received with gratitude. He is a wealthy and magnanimous man who can afford the loss and is also willing to demonstrate his benevolence. The master knows full well that in the local village, a great round of celebration in praise of him has already started. The master, as the most noble and most generous man that ever rented land in their district, has two alternatives. He can go back to the debtors and explain it was all a mistake, that the steward had been dismissed and that his actions were null and void. But if the manager does this now, the villager's joy will turn to anger and he will be cursed for his stinginess. Second, he can keep silent, accept the praise that is being showered on him, and allow the clever steward to ride high on the wave of popular enthusiasm. This master is a generous man. He does not jail the steward earlier. To be generous is a primary quality of a nobleman of the East. He reflects for a moment and then turns to his steward and says, "You are a very wise fellow." One of the biblical definitions of wisdom is an instinct for self-preservation. The questionable financial practices of the dishonest steward in Yeshua's parable recall the policies of the Dead Sea community, the community of Essenes. By the way, there were some positive aspects of the Essene community, but these negative aspects seem to outweigh them. Number one, in the Essene community, the Dead Sea community, they confiscated all the financial holdings and personal belongings of their members. And as religious isolationists, they kept their money within the sect. They rejected all business ties with outsiders. The Manual of Discipline, this is a quote from the Manual of Discipline. By the way, this is known as 1QS. It was discovered in the Q is Qumran, the 1 is Cave 1, and the S stands for Serech Hayachad, Rule of the Community, or the manner, a manual of discipline for the community. But look at what it says. Everyone who wishes to join the community must pledge to love all the children of light. Who were the children of light? Members of the Essene sect. And notice, and to hate all the children of darkness. Who are the children of darkness? Everyone outside the Essene sect. So the children of darkness were both Jews and Gentiles. The children of darkness were Sadducees and Pharisees and Zealots and Herodians and Hellenists, right? And Gentiles generally. All of the nations of the earth. In other words, if you weren't part of the Essene community, if you weren't a child of the light, then you were a child of the devil, a child of the darkness. The strict separatism of the community was all-encompassing. Financial involvement with outsiders was forbidden, except for simple cash purchases. And here are several other quotes from the Manual of Discipline, the middle one from the Damascus document. Likewise, no man shall consort with him, the outsider, in regard to his work or property, lest he be burdened with guilt of his sin. He shall indeed keep away from him all things. No member of the community shall follow them in matters of doctrine and justice, or eat or drink anything of theirs, or take anything from them, except for a price that is a payment. For all those not reckoned in his covenant are to be set apart together with all that is theirs. All their deeds are defilement before God, and all their property is unclean. I don't know if you can appreciate the extent or the significance of a statement like this, but the people that were part of the Essene community regarded all outsiders as defiled. They were filthy. The priesthood was filthy. The temple services in Jerusalem were filthy. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, all of the other sects in Judaism were filthy, right? They were defiled before God, and their property was unclean. They were the only ones walking in God's ways in the way that God instructed them to. Everybody else was failing at their desire to walk in God's ways or to serve Him. From the Damascus document, no member of the covenant of God, and this is a member of the Essene sect, shall give or receive anything from the sons of the pit, all other people, except for payment, that is cash. No man shall form any association for buying and selling without informing the guardian of the camp, and shall act on his advice, right? Or, in some translations, act on his written consent, right? Which is even stronger. The last citation here, as for the property, literally the wealth, of the men of holiness, which were obviously the members of the Essene sect, who walk in perfection, it shall not be merged with that is the wealth of the men of injustice, all other people, who have not purified their life by separating themselves from iniquity and walking in the way of perfection. Of special interest is the terminology here used for money, belonging to those outside the Essene fold, the wealth of the men of injustice, that is, the wealth of unrighteousness or wickedness. It's a dynamic equivalent to the Greek worldly wealth, which is the way the NIV translates the term, or the way the King James Version translates the term in Luke 16:9. The mammon of unrighteousness. For Yeshua, the test of one's faithfulness is found in the way one uses worldly wealth. So as we continue number 8, the sharp dualism between light and darkness, holiness and deceit, is an expression of sectarian hatred, which also reveals itself in the economic structure of the community. Josephus tells us that members of the community were not allowed to even give presents to their relatives without written consent. The Essenes guarded their community of wealth through strict laws and rigorous supervision. Borrowing language from the Dead Sea sect, Yeshua cleverly ridiculed their attitude toward money. Like the Pharisees and the rabbis after them, Yeshua emphasized almsgiving to alleviate human suffering. So with regard to money, Yeshua and the rabbis, regarding the proper use of money, Yeshua and the rabbis have much in common. A person of faith should be characterized by charity and good deeds, which will be rewarded in the world to come. According to this Midrash, Derech Eretz Zuta, give it to those who need it in this world in order that you may get the world to come. So the parable also teaches that God's grace is unlimited. The master is like God when he allows the release of debts to stand and praises the dishonest steward. Therefore, the separatism of the Essene community of wealth must be completely rejected. Clearly, Yeshua wanted his followers to have contact with the people outside his movement. In fact, he was well known for his association with individuals of ill repute. Why? Because Yeshua loved them. It is only through unfettered personal interaction with people that their needs can be identified and met. A generous heart will win friends and enable others to see the grace of God at work in their lives. So I think the reason why this parable is so important, particularly its emphasis, has to do with what the Rebbe discusses in this particular essay, right? That we have an obligation, a responsibility, as long as we are in the galut, to interact with others, right, around us in ways that help us to identify their needs and cultivate relationships so that we can, you know, interact with them and have an impact in their lives. I mean, the whole concept of tikkun olam, repairing the world, is doing what we can do to make sure that, you know, that we shine a light in the darkness and that the light has an impact, right? But if we condemn everyone outside of our sphere of influence, right, outside of those who think and believe like we do, if we condemn them, right, then we're doing exactly what the Essenes did, right? We are condemning them. We are distancing ourselves from them. We are separating ourselves from them, right? We are, in essence, expressing precisely what the Essenes did in their own communities by disassociating themselves with anybody whose theology or community was differentiated from their own, right? They were all condemned. They were all evil. They were all no good. I mean, frankly, it sounds a lot like the kind of hatred that seems so characteristic of the United States today, right? The hatred that characterizes political discussion, religious discussion, characterizes, you know, relationships that people have with others who don't think exactly like they do about various things, right? In other words, the Essenes couldn't bring themselves to say that others were serving God in whatever capacity they felt comfortable with, or in whatever ways they felt comfortable with, or in whatever ways they felt were appropriate or just or right, right? Now, is there any question that there was corruption among the Sadducees? No. I mean, the high priests in the days of the Essenes were for the most part appointed by Rome. They weren't necessarily descendants of Aaron. They were political appointees, right? So, what do political appointees tend to emphasize in their administration of activities, right? They tend to, you know, kind of follow the party line and try to act in ways that make the individuals who appointed them proud of their achievements and appreciative of their achievements so that they remain in power, right? I mean, that's the way things were in the first century when Yeshua was here. And, of course, in addition to the political appointment of the priests, or many of the priests, particularly the high priest, were governors or procreators procurators like Pontius Pilate and others, right? So there is no question that people living in the first century, Jews who had a heart for God living in the first century, had to deal with political corruption, right? Had to deal with people taking advantage of others. That is just the way it seems as though life sometimes works, right? But according to the parable, the solution is not to withdraw, right? Is not to withdraw and isolate yourself from the galut in which we live, right? So that we effectively have no meaningful impact in the lives of others, right? I mean, we, of all people, should be able to say that someone else's opinion is just that, an opinion, which is shaped by who they are, what they've been through, by their own personal and private experiences, right? It doesn't represent an evil necessarily. You know, I mean, as for the Essenes, anybody who disagreed with them was evil, was of the devil, was from the pit. That view was from the pit. And it was all it was to facilitate, which is the kind of language you hear today in the United States, right? I mean, every opinion that doesn't toe the party line will result in the destruction of the United States, right? I mean, so it has to be countered in a forceful and appropriate way, right? I mean, everybody is out to destroy us. And, you know, we have to somehow hold on to what, you know, what made this nation the kind of nation it is. And everything else, in spite of whatever it is that they say or do or believe, is evil, right? It's all evil. Well, it's difficult to live in a place that's like that, right? Because of how short-sighted and demeaning it is, right? It doesn't emphasize treating each other with decency and respect, right? It more focuses on whatever condemnation is coming on those who, you know, who walk in the ways which are contrary to the ways of the established, you know, the people who happen to be in power. I mean, it's kind of discouraging. But this parable is meaningful, in my opinion, because of the emphasis it puts on making a home in the galut, right? In other words, making the most of whatever resources we have, making the most of the opportunities we have to interact with people meaningfully and you know, doing what we can to make things better for others, right? While at the same time recognizing that we're just passing through. I mean, somehow we have to affirm that both values are good, right? The idea that we live here, we have to make the best of our circumstances here on the one hand, and on the other hand, we're just passing through. So, we shouldn't ever get too attached to things here, right? Because we have to be comfortable with the possibility of moving on whenever it is that that takes place, right? So, moving on is something that we should not be afraid of either. We should welcome that transition when it is time for the Lord to take us. At any rate, I'm going to stop here and see if there are any comments about what we've talked about. I see there's several chats, so good. Any comments before we go to the chats? Anyone?
Yeah, Rabbi. Good. Today's lesson is good for just as a reminder. And 2024 is very had a lot of different things go on that allowed us to maybe get more insulated in our own thoughts and our own prides. And
yeah.
So, yeah, it's a good reminder that to look past some of that and not deter from the connection and the things that God has given us to share with others to make, you know, the tikkun olam, right?
Amen.
So, good reminder. Thank you.
Good. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. Good. Anyone else before we go?
I have a question.
Yeah.
I've always wondered about the Jacob's sons had wives, but they don't mention them. So is Jewishness from the father or from the mother? They don't mention the wife, they just mention the sons. That confuses me.
Yeah, Hebrew literature doesn't include all the details that we might expect it to. The reason why the sons are mentioned is because the sons become the patriarchs of the 12 tribes of Israel. So the sons are identified with the 12 tribes of Israel. There are a lot of details, people's names, the details of things which are left out of Jewish literature because they're not considered important for the telling of the story.
Right.
So that's why information is left out of the narrative, because it's not regarded as essential to communicating what's important about the story. And it's not as if they are unimportant, it's just that it's detail that doesn't change the direction that the storytelling is going.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right.
Good. Thanks, Viola. Anybody else before we go? Yeah, David.
I had a few things here. Observation. It seems to me, in terms of the exile, that seems to hold true of foreigners that come to this country in that they seem to have an eye for opportunity, and they're willing to work hard and to take advantage of opportunities that unfortunately people in this country sometimes are very complacent about and don't appreciate and take advantage of. That's one observation.
Yeah, that's a good one, because they take advantage of opportunities that don't exist in their countries. So when they come to a place like this, you know, frankly, the comment is kind of a sad commentary on those who live here and grow up. And, the complacency is something which can be characteristic of people who live here. That's true. That's a good observation. Yep. You have another one.
Yes, Rabbi. There's a hidden jewel in Genesis 45:11 when Joseph basically says, come to me, be here in Goshen, so that you won't become poverty stricken, because there's still 5 years of famine remaining, in that some people can survive a famine, but then they become impoverished. But in this case, it was the complete opposite. During the famine, the children of Israel, they flourished.
Yes. Yes, they did. The Lord definitely took care of them in Goshen. They not only flourish, right, but they multiply, right? They become the nation that God said they would be, which is interesting, because it's in Egypt that they actually become the nation, not in Israel. Now, eventually they would have become a nation in Israel too, but probably not as quickly or not in the same way. So, yeah, that's a good observation too. It was in the Galut that they become the people that God wanted them to be.
Right.
And those experiences in Egypt were important for them. Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Rabbi, why did the Egyptians hate or loathe shepherds? I'm just curious about that.
That's a good question. I think it's because there is a good deal said about this kind of thing, but I think it's because of their lifestyle. Shepherds, spend time out in the fields on their own, right? They come and go as they please. They're not linked or connected to an urban setting. And a good deal of Egypt, had been urbanized at that time, right? And the shepherds and their lifestyle represent a lifestyle which was very different from their own. In this particular case, as far as the Jewish or the Israelite shepherds were concerned, they believed in one God. They didn't believe in the Egyptian deities. They didn't participate in Egyptian rituals or religious services, or, in other words, they kind of lived apart from the Egyptians and didn't really participate with them in their activities, right? So apparently the land was an area that was suitable for shepherds, but it was still kind of away from urban areas. So I think that's probably a part of it. There's, I'm sure, more, but that's a part of it.
And Rabbi, one last thing is it says in Genesis chapter 47, verses 20, 21, that the Egyptians basically, once they ran out of money, then they sold their livestock. And then they basically sold their land and themselves into servitude or serfdom. And I'm curious, what did the Canaanites do after the Canaanites sold their livestock for food? Did the Canaanites as well?
Well,
sell whatever land they had in Canaan themselves too?
It kind of depended on I'm not sure how far, how much of the land was enveloped by the famine. I would guess that this is something that was true of the Canaanites too. I mean, but when Joseph or when Jacob sends his sons to Egypt to buy grain, they had money for it, right? So I would guess that was probably true of other people living in the land of Israel at that time too, right? It kind of depends. I'm not sure what people would have done. I can't think of anything which talks about Canaanites selling themselves into slavery to Egypt, right? So they must have had some resources with which to buy grain or to make ends meet. And they may have, gotten grain or foodstuffs from other areas too, right? I mean, there's no question that Egypt supplied the grain to all of the countries around Egypt and in the land. But I don't know if it would have had any impact in places like north of Israel in the Lebanon or modern Syria or Babylon or places like that. I don't know how far. I mean, it talks about, the famine being worldwide, but worldwide in Hebrew doesn't mean what worldwide means in English. Right? In Hebrew, in English, worldwide means the whole known world. Right? In Hebrew, worldwide means the sphere of Egyptian influence. So it doesn't mean the whole world. It just means whatever the world meant to Egypt, right? Not to the planet, right? It doesn't mean that there was a famine all over the planet, right? That's the way it sounds from English translations, but that's not the way Hebrew works. So I don't know if that helps at all, but yeah, makes a difference. Yeah, good. Okay, good. Thanks, David. Appreciate the comments. Let me look at a couple of the chats at the moment. There's a few highs and hellos. And then there's from Susanna, Shabbat Shalom. Just getting in from out of town and want to catch part of the lesson. Sorry for my late arrival, no problem. From Shabbat Shalom, from Rivka, and from Warren. From Susanna, were the Essenes the same as the Karaites? And how could they fully follow the Torah without the required sacrifices for purity, sin, etc.? Or did they have their own? No, the Essenes are not the Karaites. Karaites are descendants of the Sadducees. Modern-day Karaites are descendants from modern-day Sadducees. Karaites, like the Sadducees in biblical times, emphasize their rejection of the Mishnah, of the rabbinic oral Torah, the oral Torah of the Pharisees. The Sadducees said that they didn't observe or follow the written Torah, the oral Torah, just the written Torah. And that's something that the Karaites emphasize in their theology too, that they only follow the written Torah. It's very similar to the Christian emphasis in some circles on sola scriptura, right? Only the scriptures, only the written word. But the problem, as we've discovered, is that the written word doesn't tell us how to do all of the things that we are instructed to do, right? So a oral tradition is required. So the Sadducees had an oral tradition. They just didn't call it the oral tradition, but they had one. And this is something that I talk about in my teaching on the sacred name movement and on aspects of the Jewish calendar. And the Karaites have an oral tradition too. And Christians have an oral tradition too. I mean, obviously the celebration of Christmas and Easter have no biblical precedence, but it doesn't prevent people from celebrating these holidays. I mean, if that doesn't reflect an oral tradition, then I'm not sure what would, right? So, because the Torah does not follow through with instructions to do much of what it says, an oral tradition is required. And it's ironic that everyone who claims to follow exclusively the written word, they all have an oral tradition because they can't follow the Torah without one, right? So that's something characteristic of modern Karaites. With regard to the sacrifices, they did not offer sacrifices, as far as I know, but they did engage in the other things that are required for purity, for example, like being immersed in a mikvah, for example. So I would guess that they probably felt like because of their emphasis on the nature of their community, right? I would guess that they were inclined to imagine that they didn't really sin in the way that other people did, and that their frequent washings and cleansings and immersions throughout the day, by the way, not just on occasions when someone might be defiled, for example, by coming in contact with a dead body, but they would have immersed themselves several times during the day. And of course, in the archaeological remains of the Dead Sea community, of this Essene community, there are many, many mikvaot, to fulfill or to satisfy that purpose. So they did not offer sacrifices that I know of. So they would have done the other things, prayer, immersion, those other things that are required for purity would have been, that's what they would have done. From Rivka brings to mind not helping the poor by giving them money because they'll buy alcohol or drugs. This is something that is frequently said. One of the reasons why people don't, or one of the reasons that people say they don't give money to, you know, people who solicit funds on street corners and things like that, is because they're convinced that the people will use the money to buy alcohol or to buy drugs. But of course, that really isn't our decision to make, particularly when there's no evidence one way or the other. Once the money leaves our hands, this is what Rivka is adding, to help someone, it is no longer our business. It's between them and God. A person can look altogether, and use the money for evil, whereas a person can look despised yet use the money for good, right? That's a great observation, right? Just because someone looks like they have their act together doesn't mean they do. And just because someone looks like they don't have their act together doesn't mean they don't, right? I mean, there's a big difference between we're told not to base decisions solely on what we perceive with our eyes, right? Because there's more to a person's life than what we perceive of them on the outside or based upon our own prejudices, right? So very good. Thanks, Rivka. From Susanna, friendly reminder, be in the world, not of it. From Romans 12, right? Don't keep the salt in the salt shaker, right? Or don't put a light under a bushel, right? Those things are true. So we're supposed to be in the world, but not of the world, but we're supposed to interact with the world. That's correct. Thanks, Susanna. Also from Rivka, the first temple was destroyed by idolatry, or because of idolatry. The second temple was destroyed because we hated our neighbor without justification, right? In other words, the rabbis, according to the rabbis, the second temple was destroyed because the community, the Jewish community, engaged in undue or unprovoked hatred of each other. And that was one of the things, for example, that was done by the zealots. The zealots would sometimes put to death other members of the Jewish community who weren't as zealous for the things of God as they perceived themselves to be, right? So, when the revolt began, for example, in 66 of the Common Era, the revolt that led to the destruction of the temple in 70, that is one of the things that characterized the zealots. They had such little regard for their fellow man that they would sometimes put to death those who, you know, didn't participate with them in the rebellion. So, thank you, Rivka. And Susanna writes, very true, Rivka, to your first comment. Also from Rivka, be the light, action over words. A side note for the Shema in our two temples being destroyed Each one violated the two from the Shema. Idolatry, bowing the knee to something other than Hashem, and hating our neighbor, right? Which are the two principal or primary commandments which summarize the others, right? So those are the two most important of the commandments. Also from Rivka, would articles of faith fall under a type of oral law? That's a great question. I'm not sure I can answer it. I guess it would depend on when people produce articles of faith, they tend to cite biblical texts to substantiate them or to support them. Unfortunately, in my experience, the texts that are cited often have little or nothing to do with the point they're trying to make, right? So that could be a type of oral law, I suppose, or oral commentary or understanding, right? The oral law was a way of explaining the instructions so that they're followable. And that probably is a characteristic of articles of faith, many of the articles of faith that various churches publish. Thank you. That's a good series of comments. From Beth Ann, asking for prayer for Corey, my sister's daughter's stepson. My sister's daughter's stepson. He is being treated for two blood clots, one on his pituitary gland, uncertain where the second one is. Also for bacterial meningitis, which caused the blood clots and bad headaches. He is in ICU at Memorial Hermann in Houston. He is being treated with antibiotics and is beginning to respond to treatment and was able to respond to family after pressure was relieved from his brain. He still has a ways to go. Thank you for praying for Corey, his family, families and those treating him. Amen. Good. Beth Ann, we'll keep that in prayer. Very good. Anybody else before we go? Thank you. Yeah, Bonita, go ahead.
I just have a comment, something that I didn't even, think about. But when Stephen was stoned to death, so that meant, and who stoned him was the Jewish people, right?
Yeah, would have been, right.
Yes. So also, they also went to the people homes and drug them out?
Yeah, this was something, I wouldn't say they did that. The only individual that we know of doing that was Saul, or Paul, the one who becomes Paul. According to the text, Paul, or Saul, was very zealous, and this is something that was done. We don't really know what the basis of it was, or what the what the justification. The text, unfortunately, doesn't really tell us what is it that anyone was doing that justified that being done, right? But this is on the basis of Paul's own testimony that he does these things. So we don't really know how many people this was done to. We just know that it was something that characterized Paul's zealotry before the Lord, essentially knocks him off his high horse and speaks to him, right?
Even if it was just a few people, enough for them to scatter it, that you talk about in there.
Well, the scattering, see, this is one of the interesting things is that apparently, we don't know how widespread Paul's activities were, but we do, I think it is probably possible to speculate that there was a good deal of concern in the community about it, And so people fled. People left. And it's interesting because in the text, it says God scattered them, right? So they were scattered with the purpose or the objective of you know, essentially sharing the good news. What's interesting to me is that in Exodus 19, we looked at the passage which talked about the commission. I mean, we think about the Great Commission in Matthew 28, but frankly, the Great Commission is in Exodus 19, right? That the Israel was supposed to be a kingdom of priests, and they were supposed to intercede on behalf of the nations with God. That's what Israel was called to. And they weren't doing it, right? So, on occasions when they aren't doing what God calls them to do, he scatters them so that they do what he called them to do. And this is an example of it in this passage from the book of Acts. Yeah, interesting. Interesting the way it's worded, given what was going on.
Yeah. Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks for bringing it up. Good. Anybody else before we go? From Rivka, that's two people killed for not following suit, Stephen and Yeshua. Yeah, Stephen, Stephen's whole trial and death are interesting. It apparently happened at a time when the Sanhedrin, the court, still had the authority to execute capital sentences, which they did not earlier during the life of Yeshua. The court could convict an individual of a capital sentence and convict them to death, but they were temporarily limited in their ability to do it, right? So when Yeshua was tried, in this case, not by the Sanhedrin, not by the whole court, but by a few judges, he had to be turned over to Pilate to be put to death because, well, for two reasons. One, because the court wasn't the court. It wasn't the whole court that made the decision. And two, because they didn't have the authority to execute capital sentences during the time of Yeshua. But later, it's reinstated temporarily. It's temporarily reinstated when Stephen is brought to trial. Right. According to Rivka, corrupt judges, not Israel at large. That's correct. Yeah. Yeah, the judges who tried Yeshua were definitely corrupt judges. And if I had to guess, I would say there was four or five of them that were involved in his trial. The entire court had 70 members, but there's no question that many did not participate in the trial of Yeshua. So, good. Good comments, thank you. Anybody else before we go? Anyone?
No, Rabbi, I was going to say thank you for explaining that parable. I certainly read it wrong. It was one I struggled with a lot. I didn't read past the beginning of it. The dishonesty that I saw and the cheating. It had me confused for a long time. So thank you for explaining that.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Ed. Yeah, it's a tricky one. This parable is a tricky one. No doubt about it. Thank you. From Warren, thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. Thank you, Warren. Good to see you. Not sure where you're calling in from these days, but always good to have you. Anybody else before we go? By the way, I abbreviated the discussion regarding this parable. I think there is a teaching available in our archives and I do a more thorough job of explaining it, but there is, I mean, I didn't want to be talking about it for an hour and a half, so I kind of abbreviated some of the comments, but it's an incredibly interesting parable, particularly in terms of the things that it addresses. So, very good. Anybody else before we go? Yeah, Watina, do you have your hand up? No? Oh, okay. Anybody else? Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi. Good lesson.
Thank you. God bless you. Thank you. May the Lord be with you and keep you. Shabbat Shalom. Well, there's probably not much left of it anywhere these days, but good to see everyone. Shavuot Tov. Have a great week. And I'll look forward to seeing you during the week as we continue our weekly studies, too. So, be well. God bless you. Bye for now. Amen. Thank you. Bye for now.
Recording stopped.